It's kind of an American rite of passage. You're married now, you have a house. Your wife and her mother got a great deal on lights at Walmart. So you know what? Get up that ladder. Welcome to In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. We're coming to you, as usual, from the UBS Forum at Minnesota Public Radio. So there I am, right, for the first time, steadying myself on the gutter with a mess of green cord and clinking bulbs hanging down to the ground. Now, I'm not instinctively a Christmas light hanger, or at least I wouldn't have thought I was. Of course, I'd never have figured I'd be so into growing sunflowers this summer. Guess I'm not sure if marriage changes you or maybe just lets you admit stuff you actually cared about all along. At first, I approached the lights like a chore, but getting those glowing icicles up felt pretty good, actually. Seeing that I had a jump on the rest of the block, well, that felt even better. Pretty soon, we moved into the front porch, hanging more lights and decking out the tree I had cut down with my own two hands.
It'd be fun to do the tree in colored lights, actually.
Do we have colored lights?
Well, I'll have to go down and look now.
No. We have like a star or something at the top, right?
Yeah.
When I drive home each day in darkness, my display is waiting for me, flipped on by a timer to welcome me back to my house. And like that little timer, it seems our society is on autopilot when it comes to lighting up the holidays. We do it year after year at our homes, offices, airports, parks, malls, never really asking, why does it feel so good? Are we Americans alone in our light fixation? What do all those lights actually cost us? Do we lose anything when we chase away the darkness? Well, tonight, on this darkest week of the year, these questions are why we're here. The primal dichotomy of dark and light shapes our holiday season every bit as much as faith, family, shopping, sentimentality, or charity. Whether it's Santa on a roof, a Yule log, stories of the Star of Bethlehem, the candles on a menorah or a Kwanzaa Kinara, or the sparkling baubles and brilliantly shining store displays that help pry open our wallets, light is the centerpiece. We're calling tonight's show Lighting Up the Holidays, Feeding and Fighting Our Light Obsession. In the next hour, we've got music, interviews, stories, and lots of voices, including many guests and our audience members here in the UBS Forum. The Smarts are back as our house band tonight with a new tune we're sure you'll be humming at least until New Year's. Whether you're with us here at NPR, on the radio, your computer, your MP3 player, thank you for joining us in the loop. This is In the Loop, online at minnesotapublicradio.org/in-the-loop. We're coming at tonight's show with one big idea, that our fascination with lighting up the holidays goes beyond simple tradition and the love of bright decorations. It's probably not a coincidence that this holiday season and its lights, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, come at the darkest time of the year. Research in areas from marketing to mental health to jet lag shows that light affects us as much physically as it does psychologically. And the outcome isn't always bright. In the Loop's Sandon Totten gets us started tonight sharing his own journey to make peace with the shifting light.
Every year around October, I become a junkie. I get twitchy and irritable. I start sleeping poorly, eating less. By late November, I'm desperate. I hang out at stores after dark. My favorites are Target and Home Depot, especially the home lighting departments. I have what's called seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, and it makes me a light junkie. Without light, I get depressed. It runs in my family, way back in my family. My Swedish forebears were the first diagnosed in the 6th century by the Goth historian Jordanes. He described us as tall, meaner than the Germans, and profoundly blue during the winter. It wasn't until the 1980s, though, that SAD became an official mental disorder. Some say it's the same biological urge that drives bears to hibernate. And if I could afford that much NyQuil, I might give it a shot. But that's not an option. Just as I start slowing down, the world speeds up. I've got parties to attend, cards to send, people to see, places to be. And if I even try to duck out of the holiday season, I'm bombarded with well-meaning attempts from my friends and family to help me find my holiday cheer. It's enough to make you want to skip out on the season altogether. Which is exactly what Janet Berry and her family do. December looks a little different for them.
Christmas morning, we get up and go out on the beach in our bathing suits and have pina coladas and toast the holidays.
Janet and her family fly to Mexico for the winter. She says, if light's your drug,
go to the source. Go to where the sun really shines and it's 80 degrees and you can be in the water. I think there's a lot to be said for being gone during the darkest time and coming back and knowing every day it's getting lighter.
She has a point. While psychologists estimate that as many as 1 in 10 people in the U.S. have SAD, there's almost no documented case in any tropical climate. But if you can't head south, don't worry. There's an arsenal of gadgets designed to bring the tropics to you. Tired of those dark and dreary December mornings? Try a 10,000 lux full-spectrum Portasun light box. Just a flick of the switch and boom! You've got your personal view of the prettier side of a supernova. Just don't look directly at it. Or you could try a light visor. It's a cap with built-in LED bulbs that shines a calming green light over your eyes. I don't know if the light actually helps, but I certainly feel better every time I realize how incredibly ridiculous I look wearing it. Studies have shown that for folks with SAD, bright bulbs make a difference. But I can't help feeling that all these gadgets and trips to the beach are somehow like my overzealous friends, trying to pep me up when I just want to slow down. It makes me want to give in to the season. Not the holiday season, but the season as it actually is. The season of darkness. A few weeks ago, I met Janet. She's part of a pagan group called Circle of the Phoenix.
One of the things that I really like about how we approach the dark time is that we force ourselves to slow down and be quiet. And when you start listening to that quiet, you start listening to yourself. You start listening to what your body really wants, what your mind really wants, what your hopes and fears really are.
For pagans, darkness has a lot to offer. So on the eve of the solstice, pagans like Janet will gather around a burning candle, say a prayer, and then blow it out. Then they just sit in the darkness. It reminds me of a ritual I had as a kid. Whenever I needed to hide from a parent or escape a wedgie from my older brother, I would hop into our old laundry hamper and close the lid. I could sit there for hours in the dark. It was like a force field that kept the world at bay. I remember ranking all my best friends, making lists of my favorite foods, planning the coming school year. And even though I was surrounded by dirty clothes, it was kind of refreshing. When I came out, I was ready for a new take on life and some dinner. It's not that I want to be depressed all winter, but I can't help wonder if my body isn't trying to tell me something. Instead of our overwhelming urge to light up the world as the solstice approaches, maybe there's a reason we should slow down this time of year and take at least a few moments to hole up, turn off the lights, regroup, and get ready for the new year.
That's In the Loop's assistant producer, Sandon Totten. Right now, I want to go to somebody I know we do have in our audience tonight. Dr. Paul Arbisi has been treating a seasonal affective disorder in the Twin Cities since before it was widely recognized as a clinical condition. And Paul, thank you very much for being here. I want to ask you, how many people do you think actually have some level of this that merits treatment? And how many other folks are just kind of suffering a milder form of the blues this time of year?
Well, it really depends on how you measure it. But if you actually go out and interview people and do a very rigorous evaluation, approximately 2.5 to 5% of individuals at this latitude will have full-blown seasonal affective disorder. And then upwards of another 10 to 15% will have a milder form where they'll experience some impairment in their functioning.
How do you categorize what merits treatment, you know, a full-blown case, as you said?
Well, again, it's impairment. How much does it get in the way of your day-to-day functioning, your social functioning, your ability to concentrate and work, get into work on time?
Now, Sandon said that he suspects everything from, you know, Yule logs to strings of icicle lights are some form of light therapy, and people sort of look for whatever they can find to cheer them up this time of year. Are we self-medicating at all by hanging Christmas lights? Does that work?
From a psychological perspective, if it makes you feel good, that's great. But in terms of actually impacting seasonal affective disorder and the underlying biological dysregulation that causes seasonal affective disorder, looking at Christmas lights and other form of ambient lighting will not really impact your mood or energy.
Now, this concept is big for travel agents. There are products that are made to try and help people cope with this kind of thing. Do you feel like the advertising world, the commercial world, pushes this at all to bring it more into people's consciousness?
I don't think so. As a matter of fact, there's an anecdote I can tell about the first placebo-controlled study of seasonal affective disorder, which was done in the early 80s at the National Institute of Mental Health. And they'd assign people to a kind of inactive placebo condition. And unfortunately, they lost a number of those folks because they had learned over the course of their life to take their vacations south. And so they would leave that arm of the study and go south because they said, I'm not getting any better from these lights, which are inactive, and they split.
Now, you talk to people for your job a lot about light, about how it affects them. And just to go off on a little bit of a tangent, I'm wondering what you think it is that makes light in so many ways so wound up in our traditions of this time of year.
Well, I think there's a psychological impact of this. Light is safety, particularly if we think back upon our environment of evolutionary adaptiveness, when we had to really follow the seasons and the changing photo period. In addition, I think there is a biological factor. The studies have shown that, for example, serotonin, a neurotransmitter that's involved in depression, has its lowest turnover rate during the winters. So there's clearly a biological component to this.
Thank you. Dr. Paul Arbisi, glad to have you here with us tonight. I know our band has been thinking about this as well, because I asked them to for this particular show. We knew that our show was coming up on the darkest week of the year, that we'd be talking about what light does to you and the kind of funk that darkness can put you in when wintertime rolls around, and particularly this especially dark week. Joe Weissman, with The Smarts, you wrote the lyrics to this tune. What were you thinking about?
Well, actually, when you came to me with the assignment this time, it really corresponded very closely to something that was going on in my life. A few weeks ago, when it started getting very very dark, my wife started having really a lack of energy, had real trouble getting out of bed in the morning, and just we really thought we might be dealing with some sort of seasonal affective disorder kind of thing. It turned out she was pregnant.
A different kind of disorder.
But before we knew that, it inspired this song. And by the way, that's the first my family's heard of this news. So,
this is The Smarts. The song is Rise to Shine.
So the sun, once high, hangs heavily, drags through the sky, and I too, in my arc, am weighted down, mired in the dark, and it seems that I just can't rise to shine. Cosmic tilt put away, not to see, too valuable, rare jewelry kept out of sight, waiting for a pagan rite to lure it back, and so the people pray, lonely and afraid, time to celebrate. But it's bleak and it's cold, and I'm looking tired and I'm feeling old, and I sleep and I dream and I can't get warm, and I'm losing steam, and without you here I'd never rise to shine. Thank you.
The Smarts are Joe Weissman on bass, Jimmy Kennedy on keys, and Morris Engel on drums. I picked up a soprano sax for that one. You can hear more of their music at thesmartsband.com. Now, we wanted to really test our theory tonight on In the Loop, that this light obsession we've got is more than just American or Christian, that it's something universal. We wondered what it is about light and darkness and holidays that makes that relationship not just cultural, but human. So we put Ambar Espinoza on the case to explore some places where light shines through in other traditions, including her own.
My family is from El Salvador, where winter is not nearly as dark as in Minnesota. Still, light is a big part of our holiday celebration. When the clock hits 12 on New Year's, my mom quickly hugs and kisses my sister and me and runs off to light 3 candles.
La roja es para el amor, para que tengas una buena pareja.
She says there's a red one for love, a green one for money, and a silver or white one for health. On little pieces of paper, she writes a wish for each, puts the wish under the candle, and lets the candles burn until they die out. My mom puts all her faith for a better new year in those flickering flames. The light captures her hopes and dreams. And it's not just candlelight. On New Year's Eve, my mom also cracks an egg into a clear glass filled with half a cup of water. She leaves the glass on the balcony in the moonlight. By morning, she believes the rays of the moon will create an image from the egg white that floats to the top. In that image, she tries to read what the new year will bring. One year, she saw a sailboat, and she's convinced the sailboat prediction came true. She met a boyfriend who took her sailing a lot during the summer. My family is Catholic. These traditions, of course, are not. They come from ancient traditions of the native inhabitants of Latin America. Light is a symbol of hope. In my new home in Minnesota, I don't have to look far to see how light and the holidays mix in other cultural traditions. At Augustana Lutheran Church each year, families fill the pews as a young girl dressed in a white dress with a red sash walks down the aisle with a crown of candles on her head. The church is dark, except for those lights and the candles carried by a procession of children behind her.
It's indescribable how moving it is. It's the high point of the season, I think, for many people here.
Nina Clark of the American-Swedish Institute in Minneapolis is talking about the Santa Lucia celebration in the Swedish community. Surprisingly, it involves an Italian saint. Legend has it that Santa Lucia, with her crown of lights, came to a Swedish town on a solstice night in the Middle Ages during a famine. Clark says the tradition has survived in Scandinavia because of the extreme winter darkness.
This Lucia tradition becomes one of bringing the light into this darkest time. And so it's really, in many ways, I think, lost any association with the saint herself, and it's become just a way to try to embrace the light.
Clark says in ancient times, the darkness of winter solstice was seen as dangerous. Light was a way to keep evil at bay. Santa Lucia's crown of light was associated with safety, community, and warmth. Clark says Swedes consider the celebration, held on December 13th, as the real start of the Christmas holiday. In a newer wave of immigration to Minnesota, the Hmong from Southeast Asia have brought their traditions of light and holidays to this season. During their New Year's celebration, they burn incense, candles, and ceremonial paper money. The eldest person in the family invokes the spirit of their ancestors by lighting sticks of incense. The smoke calls in the spirits. Paku Yang's family moved to St. Paul in 1996. She says her family burns yellow paper money to honor the spirit of their elders.
We're burning the paper money for the ancestors, the elders, the one who passed over, and we're burning them to wish us luck for us for our upcoming year and giving them money for thanks for our good crop.
While it's tempting to think the urge to light up the season is truly universal, there is at least one important exception. This month, the Muslim community is celebrating Eid al-Adha. The holiday honors the Prophet Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son Ishmael for God, and it marks the end of the pilgrimage to Mecca. Murad Muhammad tells me the prayer areas of mosques won't have any special decorations or lights.
Usually traditional prayer rugs, some architectural artwork, but beyond that, you likely won't see too much decoration.
Would you see any candles?
Definitely not. In fact, I can't recall the last time I saw a candle in a mosque.
So lighting up the holidays is not a universal desire or practice across all religions and cultures. Yet for many, it is a symbol of banishing darkness and evil, or of wishing for blessings in a new year. Yearnings we all share for warmth, safety, and hope.
That was Minnesota Public Radio's Ambar Espinoza. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. Tonight we're investigating, in our own way, how the primal dichotomy of dark and light shapes our holiday season, every bit as much as the usual suspects, faith, family, shopping, you name it. Ambar's story helped us understand a little better why light seems to be almost everywhere this time of year, the deep human values we attach to it, whether we think about it or not. Our technical producer, Alan Frechtman, the guy who makes our show run behind the scenes, is a lover of holiday lights, though not for the reasons you might expect. Please welcome, if you would, out from the shadows, our own Alan Frechtman.
Okay, I'll admit it. Even though I'm Jewish, I love Christmas. I love all the songs. Well, maybe not quite all. And I love the sounds of the season, like Salvation Army bell ringers. But most of all, I love the lights. Red, blue, green, white, blinking, chasing, clipped to roof gutters, strewn through trees, and blanketing bushes. Growing up in a middle-class Jewish neighborhood in Brooklyn, our street never quite lit up the night like a good 10,000-kilowatt Christmas display. Let's face it. An electric menorah with 7.5-watt orange bulbs wouldn't even attract a mosquito on a cool summer night. Our holiday ritual went like this. My mom would go to the hall closet with a small step stool, take down the electric menorah, which was safely stored on the top shelf in the original Fortunoff shopping bag, place it on the living room windowsill, screw in a few bulbs, and turn it on. Tradition.
Tradition!
It was a very simple gesture. The electric menorah is what you might call a plug-and-pray religious device. No need to go outside on a cold December day running up and down a ladder, stringing lights all around like a mashugana. We were raised as observant Jews, which means we enjoy observing non-Jews do all the schlepping for their holidays. Let's face it. Hanukkah, compared to Christmas, is a quiet and dim holiday. We have no catchy tunes, and please, don't sing dreidel, 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 I made it out of clay. That's become our drummer boy. There's no classic Hanukkah movie, and when was the last time you saw an after Hanukkah sale? Once the 8 nights are over, there is no lingering menorah still burning in the window well past Valentine's Day. Sure, lately there have been feeble attempts to pump up Hanukkah's shock and awe factor. You can now buy an 8-foot-high inflatable menorah for your front lawn. And the menorahs now come in a variety of styles. There are Mickey Mouse menorahs, menorahs with sports themes, and believe it or not, a banjo menorah. Tell me, how can an instrument popular south of the Mason-Dixon line be considered a Jewish symbol? Now, Christmas may have begun with the simple birth of a Jewish baby boy, Mazel Tov. But it's become the mother of all holidays. Unlike Christmas, Hanukkah has never inspired the creation of mythical characters such as Santa Claus or Frosty the Snowman. We have no Hanukkah Harry delivering gifts, no Hanukkah elves building dreidels in a unionized workshop, and certainly no songs like Yosef the pug-nosed reindeer had a very Gentile nose. Not that we Jews can't appreciate Christmas lights. Hanukkah, after all, is called the Festival of Lights. It's about a struggle for freedom that ended with a miracle. It's the story of light defying darkness. Lighting a candle for each of the 8 nights of Hanukkah is a small gesture tiny in comparison to the darkness out there. But it reminds Jews and all of us to never underestimate the power of light. The menorah symbolizes a divine light and has nothing to do with the number of lumens it gives out. So to all my Christian friends, Merry Christmas, and thanks for hanging those lights, running those cables, flipping those switches, and please don't ever feel guilty for lighting up the darkness, because that is why we light the menorah, just with a little less wattage. Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah to you, Alan. That's In the Loop's technical producer, Alan Frechtman.
One, two, three!
Now that we've celebrated light quite a bit through the first half of our show, we're going to shift perspectives and explore the darker side of lighting up the holidays. What does it cost us as individuals and society to drive away the darkness this time of year? We all probably know holiday light fanatics, people like, say, Jerry Fink of South St. Paul, whose zeal to inspire holiday cheer, mixed with maybe a little competitive drive, turns the basic building block of the light bulb into something, well, colossal. In their yards.
Well, up on the hill there, we have the manger scene. Three wise men, the shepherd, the sheep, the donkey.
They all light up.
And the camels, yes, they all light up.
Jerry walks from outlet to outlet, bringing his yard to life in South St. Paul. Dozens of fans start blowing, and lumps of canvas lurch upward from the lawn.
Looks like everything's starting to move.
Your whole yard's coming to life here.
Yeah.
You got SpongeBob over there and the Nutcracker.
Outside of that, I have 135 plastic figurines. Each one lights up.
Any idea how many bulbs are involved in the whole project?
We have right around 15,000, we counted up.
Jerry's holiday spirit comes at a price. He figures he's got about $8,000 in decorations. It takes him 100 hours to string all the lights. And for the first time last year, Jerry actually ran the numbers on how much power he was using.
Our power consumption was running us around $500 for the season, extra on our bill.
Now, with 15,000 bulbs and an army of inflatables, Jerry makes the papers. Buses and limos pass by on tours. But for every Jerry Fink, there are thousands of more modest displays drawing extra power from the grid. Like, for example, mine. I'm standing in the soft glow of my house in the cold, and I'm going to do something I don't usually do here in my front yard, math. Now, across my front awning this year, I've got two strings of icicle lights with 300 mini bulbs each. Inside my front porch are another two strings. Our Christmas tree lives on the porch, too, with maybe 300 lights on it. So we're talking 1,500 half-watt bulbs. My timers keep them lit 7 hours a day, so that's about 250 hours from Thanksgiving to New Year's, when I think I'm going to take them down. Right now, my power company charges 7.2 cents per kilowatt hour. So you add all this up, and we're talking $13.50 for the whole season. Well, that seems like a pretty small price to pay for all this Christmas joy. But what about pollution? My power company makes 83% of its electricity from coal and natural gas. This is pretty standard for the U.S. Coal puts out 2 pounds of carbon dioxide for every kilowatt hour of electricity. Gas, about 1 pound. Apply these ratios, and it turns out my modest display of holiday spirit accounts for 252 additional pounds of carbon dioxide Santa and his reindeer get to fly through on the way to my rooftop. Turns out that's not as much CO2 as I spew from my tailpipe burning one tank of gas as I tool around town looking for the perfect gift. But with global warming a generally accepted fact, those extra contributions this time of year do add up. Putting aside the massive commercial and municipal displays, let's say 1 in 20 U.S. households had a display as large as mine. That's $75 million of electricity and 1.4 billion pounds of carbon dioxide. And to be thorough, there is one more cost worth asking about: light pollution, which can confuse nocturnal animals and dulls our view of the night sky. That matters a lot to some people.
I'm Josh Nolenberg. I'm an astronomer, and that means basically I study levels of light.
So tell me about the little tool that we're carrying with us here tonight.
Well, basically it's a light sensor. When I point it at an object that's giving off some light, it'll tell us exactly how much light is coming from that object.
So we're standing here in St. Paul's Rice Park before a Christmas tree that is said to have 50,000 lights on it. Should we try and get a measurement?
Let's do it. Got 20.6 microwatts.
Now, can you put that in context for me? What is 20.6 microwatts?
Well, it's not a lot of power, but keep in mind that that's power from the photons that are coming from the tree itself.
So this tree is covered with 50,000 colored bulbs. There are trees all over the park that are strung with thousands and thousands of white bulbs in a spot that otherwise would be pretty dim this time of night. Should we care about that at all?
Well, there is a lot of light pollution already, and it's that diffuse orange glow that you see over cities. The holiday lights do add to that, but on the other hand, certain types of lights are better than others.
Our astronomer is a fan of LED Christmas lights, which are getting a big commercial push this year. While the standard incandescents throw their light off in all directions, LEDs are directional, which means if they're set up in a mindful way, much less light escapes up into the sky, where no one can enjoy it anyway. LED lights are also a revolution on the electricity front. Each bulb gives more light with just a fraction of the power used by an incandescent. Jerry Fink, the homeowner from a few minutes ago, is starting to make the switch and hoping it'll make a big dent in his $500 power charge. But LED strings are pricey, more than a dollar per foot. It'll be some time before they replace the bargain lights most people still use. So what is an environmentally conscious holiday light addict to do? I called up a particularly conspicuous homeowner, Alec Komernitsky, in Boulder, Colorado.
What I have, Jeff, is 15,000 Christmas lights and several inflatables. And I've got three webcams that people on the Internet can not only view those Christmas lights and decorations, they can actually control them. They can turn them on and off with a click of a mouse.
Alec soothes his conscience by paying extra to his power company to support wind energy. And each holiday season, he calculates his carbon emissions and makes a compensating donation toward alternative energy research.
I mean, I don't want to raise the flag and say I'm such a great guy, blah, 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 I'm Al Gore's buddy or whatever. But I don't know, I just thought it was kind of a good thing to do.
Alec has also used his website to raise more than $15,000 for research into an autoimmune disease that affects his two sons. Apparently, his lights put people in a giving mood. So, in the end, there is no easy way to complete the math equation on holiday lights. We can measure the cost in dollars, carbon, or adding to the dull orange glow that surrounds our cities and towns. But until someone figures out a scientific measurement for holiday cheer and the goodwill it inspires, the benefits will be much more difficult to pin down. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. We're online if you're interested in learning more about us at minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop. Now, this is not your usual radio show. It is created with the help of people like you in the audience on our website, on gather.com, and a hearty band of co-conspirators in the Twin Cities who join us once a month in a bar or coffee shop to figure out the theme for the next show. I was struck by what one person said as we plotted this particular show tonight. He spoke about the brilliant Minnesota sunshine you can get on a freezing day in January. As he put it, the light just flows into your soul. That's pretty powerful, and light can have a powerful effect on us. To think more about light and how it affects us, I've got a couple of people here whose job it is to influence us with light to some degree, and often without our conscious knowledge. First, we have Robert Johnson, who is the owner of Neo Neon in Minneapolis. He's an artist who works with light in all shapes and colors, neon in particular. Robert, thank you for being here.
Hi, Jeff.
Next to him, we have Terry Pounds, who is a producer for a home shopping network that we are going to leave nameless for tonight. And Terry, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure people are a little curious why you're joining us, and we'll move on to that in a moment. But I want to start first with you, Robert.
Sure.
As somebody who works with light for a living, who has studied this, what do you make of all of us amateurs deciding to go at it this time of year?
I love it. It's so fun to drive around and see all the colors that I get to play with every day, thrown up on huge trees outside in people's yards. And I love this time of year, actually, because it's so light, actually, in a way.
And Robert, your job is not just to cast light, but to really capture it inside neon tubes, in a way. What is so powerful to you about capturing light?
Well, to paraphrase a philosopher quote that I love, light is something that is inaccessible yet makes things accessible. And when you think about that, I mean, you can't touch light, you can't feel light, but it's there to illuminate everything around you. My work in playing with neon is using light as the object itself. My artwork are objects that are created with light. It's not light reflecting off of the surface that most of us take advantage of every day.
Well, let me move on to you, Terry. I'm sure people are a little curious exactly what you're doing here, how you fit into this light topic. You work for a home shopping network.
That's correct.
When you're working with light, what are you primarily trying to accomplish?
Well, what my job is literally to take the dancing light that is your television set and try to encourage you to buy products via that medium. So I try to take light to manipulate how you feel about a product, how you perceive a product, and subsequently get you to buy it.
Do you feel like you're abusing light? Do you feel dirty at all, Terry?
No, thankfully, everyone who tunes into my channel knows they're being sold something. It's very much a give and take in that sense. But that doesn't change the fact that what I do is to try to cast the best light on a product, so to speak.
What are some examples, say, as we're heading into this time of year, the subtle clues that maybe we don't see coming? Even though we're looking at your channel, maybe we're just channel surfing. We're not necessarily there to buy something, but how do you catch us?
First of all, we do have to catch you. So we work a lot with bright, vivid colors, bright, vivid lights to get your attention. And then once we have it, we'll usually do things to make the product stand out against everything else in the image. The important thing to always remember with TV, and not just home shopping, is that everything on that screen is incredibly deliberate. We consider it very carefully. So we might put a tiny little spot on maybe a small product to make it pop just a little bit above everything else on that screen.
And I don't necessarily know that that's going into my brain.
Yeah, it's subtle because it's all happening in the context of an image that we created. So we don't make it so bright that you can say, oh, look at that. They made that, you know, particular coin just really blast off my screen. But it's subtle, so it does draw your eye.
So Robert, the artist, Terry, the commercial exploiter of light. You embrace that title, don't you?
Sure.
Robert, can you appreciate what someone like Terry does in the service of a different goal?
I don't have I don't have cable. but no, I can't. I mean, you know, anyone playing with light, I've always loved, you know, light. You know, it's always been something that is fascinating. Since I was in college, I was playing with light. And we all play with light in a way, no matter what we do. And, you know, whether it be on a home shopping network or purchasing fixtures for your home, we need light to live.
Robert Johnson, owner of Neo Neon in Minneapolis, thank you for being here. Terry Pounds with the unnamed home shopping network. Nice to have you both with us here on In the Loop. Take just a moment to bring the lights up again in the UBS Forum. And I'm wondering, is there anybody out there who's not so into Christmas lights? Anybody out there who feels like we give darkness short shrift? Yes.
John from St. Paul. In the last year, we found that our scientists on the bending of light have found that basically only 4% of the universe is visible. The rest of it, and it's around us, is dark energy and dark light. That concept is just kind of fascinating. We may be the first people who say that what we can't see is what is most of everything that's out there. And maybe what we're doing at times when we're dealing with the dichotomy of dark and light is trying to get a better grasp of that whole wonderful cosmos that we kind of wander around in, blinded by the light, looking for the dark.
Yes, in the front here.
I'm Suzanne from St. Paul, and I would actually just like to read a poem of Wendell Berry's in response to that.
Please do.
It's called To Know the Dark. To go in the dark with a light is to know the light. To know the dark. Go without sight, and find that the dark too blooms and sings, and is traveled by dark feet and dark wings.
Thank you very much. No harm in being prepared for a in-the-loop taping, that's for sure. Well, keep your minds in the darkness for the next few minutes, if you would. We're going to take the show in that direction. Thank you very much for getting us started. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. After bringing our lights up for that last conversation, we're going to bring them way, way down for what we've got next. Tonight's episode of In the Loop is called Lighting Up the Holidays, and we've talked for the most part about the power of light in our traditions, the money we put into it, the importance of light to our minds and our bodies. It doesn't take a scientific study to show, though many have, that we need it and that it affects us deeply. But some of us also find reason to embrace the encroaching dark, to let nature work its natural course on us. In the Loop put out a call for Odes to the Darkness to our Public Insight Network, tens of thousands of people who help inform our work at Minnesota Public Radio. We invited three people to share their thoughts with us tonight and suggest music that they thought captured the essence of their experience. So close your eyes if you wish. Please hold your applause till the end if you would. And appreciate Carol Tomer, Tim Hagen, and Wendy Morris with three tributes to darkness.
An ancient Celtic invocation says, "Be at the dawning of our life, O God, and, oh, at the darkening of our day. Amen." In the community that I serve as pastor, we gather on Sunday nights to worship in the dark. We pray using ancient Celtic texts, and we let the darkness surround us while singing haunting, melancholy melodies from Nordic lands. The people of the north had many traditions around winter darkness. For example, as the days grew shorter, they would finally accept that the daily routine could not continue. They removed the wheels from their carts and wagons, adorned them with greens, and hung them in their halls. Some say these wheels became our Advent wreaths, tools of movement transformed into symbols of rest. Imagine if we took the wheels off our cars this season. We might actually stay in place long enough to be enveloped by the dark and its primal gifts, rather than escaping for another numbing round of brightly lit hunting and gathering. But most of us keep our wheels and headlights on and our lives rolling in fast lanes. So I am grateful to be part of a contemplative worshiping community that dares to dim the lights and be guided into the mysteries by ancient and local poets and prophets. In the dark, ironically, we gain vision and discover grace and experience being held by a darkness and a God beyond our making or controlling. A holy presence in which we might hear something more than ourselves, and a divine love in which we need not say anything.
As a teenager, I was heavily into goth culture. People would often ask me why the dark clothes, the black hair, the eyeliner, the sad or morose music. I used to say it was about fashion, that I had a different view about what was attractive, or that it just made me feel invisible. But eventually I began to deeply question what it was about darkness that I was drawn to. Darkness is often associated with negativity, with sadness and loss and even death, and goth culture isn't afraid to explore those ideas, but the reason isn't to worship them. It's more of a refusal to deny what is a real and natural part of our lives just because it's painful. The more I thought about darkness, the more I saw it as a blank canvas upon which anything has the potential to be expressed. Before light, before substance, before anything exists, there is nothing but possibility. In a dark room, sometimes wearing earplugs, I put myself in a comfortable position and sit for long periods of time. In the absence of the physical world, I awaken all sorts of ideas, memories, and visions from the imagination. In this state, the senses become confused so that sometimes I can't tell where my body ends and the space surrounding it begins. And in some moments, it's like my flesh dissolves and my awareness blends into the darkness around it. In this way, the darkness becomes a teacher. It expands my perspective and reminds me of the importance of all that I think of as not me. But this expanded sense of awareness doesn't need to leave when I exit the darkness. I try to take the lessons learned with me into the busy world of movement and activity. Every moment of stillness is a chance to reconnect with the darkness.
Every year, as the holidays are literally lighting up, when the days are short and the parties are long, my family carves out what we call dark nights. On a dark night, we might huddle close around a backyard fire, pajamas tucked beneath our winter coats, or curl up on the couch under one big comforter. We entertain each other as humans have entertained themselves in the dark since before history. We tell slow stories, sing a bit, gaze off into the quiet black sky. On dark nights, we taste, if only for a few moments, the deep rest some animals might know this time of year, underground or in caves, alone and together. We nestle into one another and into the darkness. This darkness is not that lonely, desolate, lacking kind of dark, not the ominous dark of fairy tale forests or spooky alleys lurking with malevolent danger, the shadowy thief, a poisonous spider, a moldy piece of cheese, a bad politician, or a terrorist trap, a rusty nail you might step on and maybe get tetanus and then you'd turn all stiff and die. No. This is the other darkness, the deep blanket of rest that envelops vision, the darkness that welcomes us back home, womb dark, source of every creativity, reminding us we are all part night sky, part fertile earth. On a dark night, my family temporarily turns down the manufactured seasonal magic of tiny bulbs and tinsel. We take refuge in a mysterious blackness that covers the mind in silence. It's hard to know where I end and you begin. That loosening of identity used to scare me, but now, sitting together in the dark, I know what real magic is.
That was Wendy Morris. We also heard from Tim Hagen and Carol Tomer, pastor at Pilgrim Lutheran Church in St. Paul. We heard music from Sondra Bretland, Dead Can Dance, and Twin Cities artist Douglas Ewart. When we were discussing concepts for this show on light and darkness, Minnesota Public Radio producer Larissa Anderson threw out an idea. What if you couldn't see the lights that so define this time of year? On the trees, on houses, anywhere. Would they still matter? It's a fascinating question. And here now are three answers.
Hi, my name is Sandy Emslander. I was born prematurely, and because of premature birth, I was given oxygen. And at that time, they did not know that too much oxygen would cause the optic nerve to be killed, meaning that I now have no sight. I want to live as though I can see, and even though I can't see the tree, I can't see the lights, I do a lot of entertaining. So my husband, he lost his sight from diabetes, and we do put lights out on our deck. We have a tree that we decorate just like anybody else would. The entertaining part of it, the gift buying, those kind of things, to be honest with you, mean more to me than the lights do. At holidays, I know that that's what people do, and I know that that's the custom and the tradition, but they're focusing on lights. But because I can't see them and never have, it's not going to be my number one priority. I know I don't think about it as much as someone probably who has lost their vision recently.
I'm very thankful that I was able to see once before because it gives me a picture of what everything looks like. My name's Gary Betcher. I could see up to about age 12. I have a low light perception and dark perception. I cannot see any shapes or figures or anything like that. This time of the year is my most favorite holiday. I love Christmas. I love going out with friends of mine around the neighborhoods, and I like that people will describe a lot of the lights, and sometimes maybe even some of the lights might be bright enough outside that I can see them just a little bit. I just get a kick out of that. and especially when people take the time to describe it to me, that even means a lot, too. I do love to give candles to people, just because I think if they're bright enough, if I can maybe sense the light a little bit. I can't actually see it, but I think just the sense of the light and just the smell of it, I think, just really gives kind of that homey feeling. Being blind, I don't take things for granted, so I don't think I'd get as much out of it, being able to see, and I don't think I would. I think maybe I wouldn't appreciate the beauty of it. You know, maybe I'd kind of get that whole home feeling, like, okay, well, I've seen one light display, you know, seen them all or whatever.
My name is Jo Kloon. 9 years ago, at this time, it was the darkest time of my life, really. My vision was going, and I didn't think that I was going to be able to see anymore. It was December 23rd. I woke up that morning, and I could tell right away that there was a difference in my vision. They diagnosed me with optic neuritis. And so as of right now, my left eye has about a 2200 vision, and my right eye actually has very little vision. I love lights on the tree. And every year, John, my husband, always thinks I put too many lights. But I think the more lights, the happier I feel when I look at it. And I see, you know, the Christmas tree through my son because he loves the tree. Every day we come home, the first thing he'll ask is, can you turn on the lights? And so really I enjoy Christmas through him, even though I don't maybe see the lights as clearly. And instead it's kind of like a hazy glow of lights. Part of me, I mean, does miss seeing it on my own. I mean, I'm still there and I'm still experiencing it. It's just in a different way. In the beginning, when it first happened, there was this tape I got. It was all about dealing with your vision loss. And I thought it was very accurate because it compared it to losing somebody. You know, this vision loss took a lot from me. So I think Christmas is kind of bittersweet for me, you know, because it's still... it makes me kind of nervous, you know, around the 23rd every year where I get kind of nervous. I wake up and I think, you know, is today going to be different like it was? But it also kind of reminds me of how lucky I am and how fortunate I am with everything, with my family and friends. And I still have the vision that I have. So I'm a very lucky person.
Minnesota Public Radio producer Larissa Anderson put this segment together for us. All the music came from Midwestern artist Sufjan Stevens. As we near the end of our show, I want to draw out one thread running just below the surface of Larissa's piece. When light is so abundant and easy to manipulate, we pretty easily forget what a precious and amazing thing it is. Light is so prominent in various holiday traditions, and you know, it's no wonder light is such a big deal in the stories and rituals formed long ago. When they happened, light was a scarce commodity. Today, well, the Star of Bethlehem would face a little competition. So, maybe I'm just being sentimental because of the holidays, but I'm going to pick up my guitar for a tune here as we near the end of our show that we're calling Daytime to the Night. The wise men crossed the desert just by following a star. Today they'd need a GPS to tell them where they are. It might be kind of hard to pick that star out in the north when the spots from Ernie's Auto Mart keep sweeping back and forth. The wise men joined the others who were gathered round his bed, and the baby lit the whole place with the light around his head. Today we light our stadiums just like the Savior's birth, as 20,000 Jesus heads light up the AstroTurf. The Maccabees fought long and hard to take the Temple Mount. They fought back Greco-Syrians to numerous to count. The lights they had were short of fuel, but burned 8 days and nights. And so the world got Hanukkah, the festival of lights. When the Jews ran out of oil, it took a miracle to fix. They couldn't drill new holes or mess in Arab politics. Somehow it's not so easy now to make a barrel last. 8 days is just how long I take to burn a tank of gas. Time was the winter solstice was the darkest of the year. But now my giant plasma screen makes solstice disappear. would solstice be so powerful to pagans in their day? If dancing with the druids helped to pass the nights away. The peasants burn the Yule log trying to beat the cold and snow. Today our fires of gas give us that Martha Stewart glow. We need not gather round the fire to beat back winter's chill. Just a blue flame in my furnace and a pen to sign the bill. Do we take our light for granted? You know, I suppose we might. When every bulb is blazing, bringing daytime to the night. But if you're feeling guilty when you take a look around, just think how good you'll feel when all the Christmas lights come down. So if voices from the past have got you needing an excuse, you know, they'd all have done it too if they had only had the juice. So watch the pretty lights and know you wouldn't change a thing. Just have another eggnog and plug in another string. Thank you to our house band tonight, The Smarts. Hear more at thesmartsband.com. You can download live versions of their original tune this evening, Rise to Shine, as well as that last one by going to our website, minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. On the website, you can also keep up with our blog, our podcast, and sign up for our Loop network of listeners, who, as always, provided great inspiration for tonight's show. We're going to have another get-together here in the Twin Cities in early January, so keep an eye on our website for more information. Thank you to Paul Hamill in Stillwater for letting Sandin borrow some light therapy gear. Dan Olson was my hacking Santa Claus. Some live assistance this evening, invaluable, from Ambar Espinoza, Larissa Anderson, Molly Bloom, and Andrew Haig. Jeremy Pavlik has been our regular photographer. Our engineer tonight is Sam Keenan. Our technical director of the UBS Forum is Josh Kubasta. Alan Frechtman is our technical producer. Sandin Totten, our assistant producer. Michael Scholar, the executive producer of In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, and we will see you next month.